see somebody try
and make me.
Anyone who wants to try
and make me
turn into a man. Catch me if you can.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I will never even try.
I will never even try.
I will do what Peter tells me.
I will do what Peter tells me.
And I'll never ask him why.
And I'll never ask him why.
We won't grow up.
We won't grow up.
We will never grow a day.
We will never grow a day.
And if someone tries to make us,
and if someone tries to make us,
we will simply run away.
We will simply run away.
Yes, well, that was a sneak preview into Gavin Newsom's meeting about the oil and gas problem. I'm pretty sure that's what they play in the background because there seems to be a no adult supervision in the room. You have rejoined We the People Radio for the second hour. Bill didn't like the Peter Pan song. He has a scowl on his face. He has a scowl for radio.
I'm not big on Disney either.
Oh, but you know what? It's just so ludicrous, honestly. It's just crazy. So, we have Mike Ariza, Assemblyman Stan Ellis, and Professor Michael Miché. I thought if I did it in a different order, I would do a better job with us today. You can follow their interviews, not just on our program, but the ones with California Insider. Katie Grimes has been doing quite a bit on this. So articles and things about the impending gas shortage and the refineries going down and all of that, you should really get informed. And now would be a good time to do that. You can find it at gascrisis.org. It sends you to the radio page, but that's easier to remember. So if you use gascrisis.org and shoot it to some other folks, they can get on there. You can read, you can listen, you can watch. So whatever you like to do, there's something there for you on this topic. All right, men, we're back. Back to the grind. What would we like to hit this hour? I know, Professor, you were in the midst of something in the news got in our way.
Oh, no, just I'm just going to say, you know, it's just incredible when you think about you're trying to manipulate 39 million people into buying a product which most of them don't want to have and can't afford.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that in itself, and that's not conjecture on my part. Those are, you know, that's Gavin Newsom's stated position, to use the market power and the legislative force of California to address climate change. And the method he wants to use is increase these gasoline prices to an intolerable level to force people out of internal combustion cars into EVs, when in fact the market is showing unequivocally they're not that interested in owning EVs. Of course sales went up before the subsidies ran out. So sales went up considerably in August and September. September had a huge run-up. The subsidies went out in October, and sales have come crashing down. And they're probably going to stay at that level. And the interesting aspect of that is that, you know, Governor Newsom said, well, let's allocate $200 million as subsidies for EV sales for California. Well, the state's already $1.6 trillion in debt, so I guess another $200 million doesn't really matter. But the point is that the people that buy EVs are higher-income individuals. The data shows this, and the preponderance of registrations in California are along the coast, and they're in places like, you know, Atherton and Belvedere and Brentwood and Beverly Hills, Montecito, really the high affluent areas. And so the people that probably don't need the subsidy are the ones who are buying the EVs. So it would seem to me if you're going to provide a subsidy and you want people to buy EVs, do it for lower income individuals, under below, say, $125,000. But for some reason, the state hasn't gotten to that level of sophistication yet.
Well,
or awareness.
We also don't have the grid capacity to handle the level of EV conversion that they are, in their childish you know, mathematics that, that they've come up with. We can't even support that.
Oh, it's somewhat hilarious, right? If you think those of us who were around back in the Gray Davis days when we had these massive brownouts and blackouts occurring in California in 2000, 2001, if you think that's bad, wait until, imagine if you had 19 million EVs plug in tonight at 7 o'clock at night. What do you think is going to happen to the grid?
Yeah, exactly.
Grid's down. Yeah, grid's offline.
It's just going to come down.
So for all the people who think, oh, well, you know, maybe they have the ability to do that, just, you know, run out and buy an EV. Well, I guess if gas gets too high, I'll just run out and do that. Well, we just created another problem.
Yeah.
It's also...
Yeah, a big-time problem.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, it comes to the point where we get... It's called point of diminishing marginal returns, right? So we're at a point of diminishing returns. Go ahead and pass legislation, but what are you really getting out of it other than additional hardship and cost for the average hardworking California consumer? They can't afford it, right? So think about this, right? California produces less than 1% of total greenhouse emissions. That's the 1%.
Yeah.
So what is California truly accomplishing by forcing consumers to change their behavior and by imposing these draconian costs on the consumer?
Well, Professor, Professor just made a great comment. I was standing by to make the comment that if you take where we're getting our crude oil and our gas and all of those refineries that are polluting and China's polluting, they have no environmental standards whatsoever, and we're getting 40% of our gas and diesel from India, and they have no environmental standards. I've worked in several countries around the world in chemical process. I promise you, they have nothing compared to California. We put out the cleanest gas and oil in the world. So thanks for bringing that up, Professor.
Oh, no. I mean, we do have the most stringent standards and the best production standards in the world here in California. Plus, we're sitting on the fifth largest reserves in the United States in California. At one time, California was the world's number one producer and exporter of oil. Granted, it was a long time ago, but we were number one. Today, we are the most heavily dependent of all 50 states on foreign-based oil. It just simply is incomprehensible why someone would think this is a good policy, given the fact that you got a $1.6 trillion debt. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and in those terms, too, like you're saying, we're also the most dependent state on imported fuels by far. And the one thing that really frustrates me is they keep hearing about how, well, we got control of this. And it's like, no, sir, you do not have control of storms that can delay ships. You don't have control of refineries going down unexpectedly. You don't have control of different situations in the world that could occur to cause us to have shortages of jet gasoline and diesel. You don't have control of so many things, you know, like the ship that caught fire at the dock at the Port of Los Angeles. You don't have control of these things. The governor's totally disingenuous when he looks at us and says, yeah, well, you know, we got this handled. No, you don't. You can't control these things. And we are now 42-44% of our gasolines being imported. The vulnerability us and the military are at. And the thing is, back in the 70s, once the crude oil resumed, we had, like in California, we had 40 or 41 refineries. Refineries came back up and the country got itself back out, you know, the problem that it was in. But, you know, you're sitting there saying, we get into a shortage, if we get into a moderate shortage, or, God forbid, a severe shortage, we do not have the refineries to pull us out of it. So there's a more than reasonable chance we will see severe civil unrest in all of our metropolitan areas, as the professor pointed out, Reno, Las Vegas, Phoenix, same thing there. Same thing with the prices, same thing with the shortages. And in California, we do not have the ability to get ourselves out of it. We cannot increase crude oil to refineries that don't exist and refine our way out of it. That's the problem we're in. That's the serious danger. That's the real danger that we're in. And we have to have presidential intervention, like Stan was saying. We have to have federal intervention where federal EPA takes over CARB and then works with refiners like Valero and others and see, you know, to determine what can we do to keep you open and get you back online. Because right now we're in serious danger.
Well, if you're a refinery and let's say the administration comes in and does make those changes, you know, let's say they do make those changes, right? And it does make a difference. Well, the spooky part is, let's say the refinery says, okay, whew, you know, we no longer have the gun to our head. We can produce. Sure. We'll keep doing that. Well, in a few years, that can all change again, and they're right back where they started. Is there any kind of...
I think that's the fear.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. I'm not at liberty to say, but I've seen someone's cap-and-trade charges a refinery in the state of California, and it's escalated, and one of them, I think this next year, was $140 million or $133 million for just cap and trade.
And so, Stan, explain for people who hear that thrown around a lot, what exactly, explain how stupid that really is.
Yeah, so cap and trade was, I don't know how many years ago they came up with the idea, but they wanted to charge for people that put out emissions. So when you burn natural gas in these refineries, what happens as coming out the stack, you have what's called carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitric oxide, some sulfur compounds, and others, okay? So they take, and they're molecular compounds, but they have weight. So they measure those in weight and tons per year. So when you put out so many tons per year, you have to pay into the state of California for putting out that many tons. So the more you refine, or the more you make cement, or the more you make any other, all the boilers and oil and gas, and they do steam injection, they use boilers. Everywhere that you have energy consumed and you have an emission, guess what? You get charged for it. And that's the problem that I have with California, and that's why these refiners cannot stay in business. You cannot pay over $100 million a year for cap and trade. They talk about oil and the gas companies and getting rich. No, they're not. They're going broke, and that's why they're leaving California.
So, okay, Stan, you're a refinery now, and and the Trump administration comes in and says, hey, look, we're gonna need to, you know, kind of lay a federal hand on this thing and stop this. California Air Resources Board and all the rest of this craziness, because we really need you guys to produce, jet fuel and gas and whatever all else you're making. And so we're going to make that stop. Does it pencil for you to say, okay, I'll do it, knowing that that potentially goes away in 3 years?
No. If you said it's going away in 3 years, and that's why we have to have legislation, actually, we have to have state legislation, which is going to be probably impossible because of the green agenda, and federal, but you're absolutely right. It helps short term if some people that have already made the investment want to stay, but people that have already gone, there's no reason to come back and start spend $500 million starting on Valero when you can't advertise that over 3 years and make any money.
Yeah.
And you don't have the ability. You lose the ability to restart it, even if you wanted to, because all of the qualified people that can restart that refinery are gone.
Yeah, they moved.
Exactly. Yep.
They moved. They're not coming back. So
you think about it. If you're in your 40s or 50s and you're offered a transfer to Louisiana or Texas, and you're making the same salary or more, and you're going to have. You're going to be able to keep your years that you've been working for the company, because they offered a lot of people transfers. I mean, if I was 45 and still working for them, I'd be gone. I wouldn't even think twice about it. Goodbye.
Yeah. So that makes no sense. What do you guys, just from your vantage points, do you think this precipitates a major... do you think this pushes voters in the state of California to reevaluate the direction that the folks they're sending to Sacramento are headed.
You kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that we have to get a lot worse so we can eventually get some red folks in. But it's not going to happen until the truth is out there where gas is $10 a gallon and there's gas lines. And then guess what they're going to do? They're going to blame Trump.
Right.
Because that's, that's what the Democrats do. Everything that comes down the pike, they blame Trump instead of blaming themselves. So I'm frankly not very optimistic. We need to get some Republicans voted in so we don't have a super minority so we can at least stop some of this legislation.
Yeah, because just for people who don't live in the state, you know, the ability for you in the assembly to make change is zero, but explain to them why.
So there in the assembly in the state of California, there are 80 assembly members that represent, you know, what, 40 million people. We all represent about a half a million. I represent a half a million people. And so then out of the 80, there are 20 Republicans and 60 Democrats. On the Senate side, there are 30, and of which 10 are Democrats and 20, I'm sorry, 20 are Democrats and 10 are Republicans. So no matter what we do, no matter what we vote on, it doesn't matter. Our vote does not count. So what we have to do is we have to increase the assembly, I think, by 6 or 10 more to at least be able to stop all this ridiculous legislation. And we got to have like 3 or 4 more on the Senate side.
Okay, so stick with the politics. And in November, we have a gubernatorial election. And, you know, we have the, you know, brain trust of Katie, what's-her-face, who screams at everybody, and Eric Swalwell. We'll leave out all the fang-fang jokes, but so we've got some bad choices on that side. We've got a couple of good Republican choices, and frankly, I don't care which one. Pick one. Pick who can win. Yep. Do that.
That's right.
So let's say we elect a Republican governor.
At least he has veto power.
Yeah. So now we veto everything, but what's the ability to impact the agencies? Because that's executive branch.
That's a good question. If you're going to try to do it legislatively, we still need to put forth some legislation, and it could still get voted down.
Right.
So I don't have much faith that we're going to be able to do much, even if we had a Republican governor. But at least we'd have veto power, and it's critical that we stop some of the nonsense. That's the first thing. Stop the nonsense.
Yeah.
And then start, then when you stop the nonsense and you have a Democrat, a Republican governor, then you're going to be able to elect more Republican legislators.
Yeah. Let's ruminate on that, and we will come right back. We have to take a swift break. So, let's see. You're listening to We the People. You can find all the stuff about this oil and gas thing at gascrisis.com. .org.
Oh.
Gotcha. Because they are.
Guaranteed.
Because they're watching you.
Yes.
They want to watch you a lot more, too, given a choice. So, I remember when they came up with their 17% renewable power mandate, which sounded so magical. But
it's totally worked so far.
It's super worked so far. So we interviewed Jesus Arredondo, who was an energy policy, probably still is, energy policy attorney. Nice guy, super smart. He happened to be sitting in the meeting. And he said, hey, you want to know how they came up with that? We were like, okay, no, yes, we do, I guess. And he said, well, the first idea was 15%, but they thought that sounded too low. So then it was, how about 20? And he's kind of looking around, and there's no chart, there are no papers, no presentation, no slideshow, no nothing. And he's like, so then they, 20, but 20's kind of high, and they're kicking it around. And then, how about 17? Yeah, 17. 17
is that suspect?
Yeah, 17 sounds like a lot, but it's not unachievable. And he's like, wait, what are you guys basing this on? How are we going to get there? And they turned on him like a pack of dogs. And
it's a Q-proof.
And they said, they turned on him like a pack of dogs and said, we haven't figured that out yet. We're coming up with the goal first.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so, Stan, that's the way it works in science, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I want to give you an example.
Please do.
I'm on the assembly floor. Someone passes a bill to outlaw Teflon pans in California. So it came to a vote, and I stood up. I don't speak very often because I like to state as my science background. So I said, first of all, there are about 12,000 different chlorine and fluoride bonds, and you haven't done any acid chloride leaching on this material, so therefore it's non-leachable because I did the research. And so in your stomach, it acts like something that's inert and goes completely through you. Why do you want to outlaw Teflon pans when it's not hazardous? It's because somebody had this idea, just like you exactly quoted, that, 15% is a good number. Let's get the goal before we do the science. They didn't even do the science. It's all about putting forth ideas that have no data that backs them up, that just makes them look good to their constituents so they'll get elected. It's that simple.
So in this case, you can trust the science, right?
Exactly. Trust us. They don't. But they didn't even listen to the science. That's the bad part.
They didn't know what you were saying, actually. I don't think they actually understood it, right?
Well, and then, so let's come out to greenhouse gas, okay, and the greenhouse agenda. You know, through paleontology, you can determine global warming over the years and how much methane and ethane and our constituents by taking core samples of some of these glaciers. We've actually had some cooling trends, but they won't study the cooling trends. They only study the heating trends for their own agenda. We've had some summers that whole thing about greenhouse agenda is politically motivated. The science behind it is so back and forth, it's ridiculous.
Well, and if you disagree, you're basically a heretic, and then you get marginalized and kicked out of your whatever your industry is, whether it's science or politics or teaching or whatever your deal is. Well, look at the guy that started Greenpeace, Dr. Patrick Moore. We interviewed him a long time ago, and I was dying to know, like, why'd you leave, right? So I figured, he was tired of dealing with idiots, but he was actually better than that. He left because after they did the Save the Whales project, which apparently was based on science and was a pretty good deal, so they got done with that, and the people at Greenpeace, none of whom were scientists except for him, decided they were going to ban chlorine. And he was like, you can't ban chlorine because it's an element. And he confirmed what we knew, that they had no idea, what was on the periodic table or the fact that you can't ban a naturally occurring element. And so, Stan, I think you and Dr. Patrick Moore might want to spend some time together.
We probably do pretty well together.
You could go to therapy together.
Exactly.
So just out of curiosity, so we don't bury the lead there, do we still get to have Teflon pans?
Did we get what?
Did they ban the Teflon pans?
Yes, they actually, believe it or not,
Okay.
They listened to me for about 5 minutes, but they wouldn't close the vote. And there was a Democrat running around the room telling everybody they had to vote yes. And they ultimately voted yes and banned the PFAS or you know, the Teflon ban.
Wow. Okay. Huh. So much for, you know, so much for that.
Yeah.
things you can't explain.
Are they banning vitamin D now?
Yeah, right. Yeah, stay out of the sun.
Exactly.
It's bad for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so if science can't help us and logic is dead, honestly, and the legislature... So at this point, we tuned in with you in December, but you guys started working to try to raise the profile of the coming gas shortage and the refineries closing and all that. You guys all started this, what, 6 months ago? Ish?
Oh, at least. Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for at least 10 years in my career, but we came together, I'd say, 6-7 months ago as a team. Yeah.
And really started kind of pounding the airwaves, trying to get people to listen. And all of that, and so
because you know you have a researcher in me, you have a practitioner in Mike, and a scientist in Stan, and you know we know the math. I mean, we the math is the math, the data is the data. 2 and 2 equal 4 in our lives. You know, if Mike made a mistake in the refinery, it was a big mistake, right? He ran that refinery at a high level of precision and a high level of professionalism. He knows what valves to turn and what buttons to push. Stan and I are math guys. We understand the arithmetic and the math and the science behind it. And we began putting our numbers together and our heads together. And we said, you know, this is really actually worse than it looks. It really is.
Yeah, that was the thing. What caught my attention initially, you know, because I'm a farmer and everybody knows I work at Chico State. I'm operating engineer there. But what caught me was when I heard Phillips 66 was shutting down, and I'm just doing my thing, you know, running my life, thinking that's not good. Prices are already high enough. But then when I heard Valero was shutting down and decided to shut down, that's the most efficient advanced refinery in the state. The one I control. I mean, I ran a couple others, but the Valero was the one I ran the most. It just caught me. I'm like, what the heck is going on? Why is Valero closing? What has been going on? So I started digging in and finding out and generated my own brief. I went down to the Capitol, took a day vacation, which I'd never done before in my life. And then, you know, that's how I ended up meeting Stan. But together, we have learned so much from each other about the entire big picture. You know, there's 130 years of combined industry experience between the three of us. And it's like Professor pointed out, the researcher. I mean, I flew the plane. Stan's a scientist. We learned so much from each other. And like the professor just said, together we found out this is a hell of a lot worse than what it is. And people have no idea what's coming and what's going to hit them. And they're going to be standing around just going crazy.
Is there anyone else in the legislature at all or in, how about this? I don't care if they're in the legislature, in a position to do something about it, who has kind of joined on your with your cause and is looking for solutions or looking to press for that? Do you have others that are coming along?
From a legislative side, the Republicans are all on board. They'll help. There are some Dems, but they don't want to come out. So I've argued with them and debated with them, and they agree that they won't fight the status quo. So from the legislative side, no.
Okay, so no help coming there.
Nope. No, it's interesting there, and if I can add to what Stan said, I'll have legislators come up to me, and it happened last Wednesday, and you know, they're Democrats, and they'll say, Professor, we have a lot of respect for the work that you're doing, and your co-authors are doing. We get it. We understand the data is there. We understand the data is valid. And I'll say, well, thank you. And so can you speak out on it? No, I can't. If I speak out on this, I'll lose my privileges. I won't be appointed to the committees I want to be on. I will even lose my parking spot. And they're literally at the point where they're like, I can't do it. I don't want to lose my parking spot in the Capitol building. And unfortunately, that's where we're at. So it's difficult no matter how valid our arguments are and no matter how valid the data is, that, you know, it's come to that of political retribution or retaliation if somebody takes a contrary position, you know, to the party line at this point. I think the last, you know, one of the more defining points I think that's worth making here is what are Californians getting for what they're paying for CARB and for the CEC? You know, what are the budgets of those two agencies and what are the true results of those agencies? To what extent are Californians truly benefiting from their work? Because honestly, you know, I know they've done good work, all right? But in this instance, they should have been on this years ago.
Yeah.
Years ago.
Yeah, because this didn't just happen. This obviously is a long, slow policy burn.
And unfortunately, it'll be a long, slow process to turn it around once it takes effect. I mean, we can't...
You can't have a long... Okay. All right. If it takes as long to turn it around as it did to get us here, are we cooking over a fire at home?
Well, yeah. To a certain extent, okay? But here's what will happen. You know, if indeed these prices go to the levels that some of us think they could go, okay, or if you, and certainly if you have a significant disruption in the supply chain or a major geopolitical event in the Pacific, they will explode out of the roof. Plus, you've got pressure coming from Nevada. They have no option.
That.
They don't have a port. They got nothing, right? So you got to figure that President Trump is fully aware of this. He's on it. As a matter of fact, I know he's on it. And I think that at some point when the prices reach a threshold, you know, the hope for Californians would be federal intervention, because it's pretty clear that the state is incapable of addressing it on its own. So, and I think that's what may be in our cards. And that's what I mentioned in our presentation of February 11th. If the state doesn't step up and take action now to really address this and alleviate it and figure out how to do something, then the federal government will step in. And then California will lose pretty much a lot of the control, which they've already done. If you think about it, California has abdicated its control to foreign governments right now for gasoline and oil. So if CARB thinks or the CEC thinks they're going to dictate prices to China, good luck.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely not in a bargaining position. We're in a position of take what you can get.
It's at the mercy of. Not bargaining, at the mercy of, like the professor's saying. You're beholden to them.
Yeah.
And our military.
Can you imagine? Our military is at the mercy of the Chinese sending us fuel. I mean, you can't even make that up.
No, you can't. You know, hello, China. You know, can you send us some fuel so we can defend Taiwan, please?
Yeah, or defend against you, right?
I mean, that's
defending against them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yep. Yeah, so we can keep you from coming and taking over?
For example, right? The greenhouse gas emissions coming from Iraq, which is the number one supplier of oil to California, are 10 times greater than those that occur off of California's offshore refineries. 10 times greater. Now, California also gets a lot of fuel from Brazil. So Brazil is the number two provider of crude oil to California and the number one provider of, guess what, ethanol to California.
Mm.
Well, two things come into play here. One, to make ethanol, you need sugarcane. Brazil has burned 24 million acres of rainforest for sugarcane production, which is used for ethanol, most of which is consumed by Brazil but is also exported to California. Secondly, Brazil's offshore oil production, Brazil's oil production, is almost entirely offshore. So California is willing to take offshore oil production from Brazil, put it on a tanker, bring it through the Panama Canal, bring it up the coast, and park it outside of L.A. or San Francisco for a number of days to be offloaded, versus taking oil from Santa Barbara Channel. It's preposterous.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
When we come back, let's talk about the production that's available here in the state of California. I don't think people realize how much oil is under the ground here.
Happy to.
Let's hit that when we return. Okay, Bill, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so you're listening to We the People Radio, but this particular topic, you can get to it swiftly at gascrisis.org. Org. Winning.
Winning.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. It's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Too many lives they spin across the ocean. Too much money they spin upon the moon. Well, until they make it right, I hope they never sleep at night. They better make some changes and do it soon.
Yeah, really soon.
Oh, they're making changes.
Just the wrong ones.
Yeah.
All right. So we don't need to bring in oil from overseas or Brazil or through the Panama Canal or from outer space. We have a ton of it in the state of California under the ground, correct?
That is correct.
Yes, that's correct. But I mean, we will have to import oil because our consumption is much higher than our production. But we have a ton of oil under the ground. And as James Rector from Berkeley will tell you, California is very unique. He's a geophysicist. And so Professor Rector will say that California, as we are standing or sitting today, is making oil 20 to 25,000 feet below the surface. Oil is being constantly created in California, and because there's so much oil being created subsurface, it seeps to the top. These are called oil seeps, so it's forced up through the fissures, and it occurs all over the place. So, you know, in Los Angeles, we know it as the La Brea Tar Pit. So when you bring the little third graders to the La Brea Tar Pit to see, you know, the bones of dinosaurs, they're standing right next to greenhouse gas emissions, coming from naturally occurring seeps. And we have this off the coast of Santa Barbara. So very interesting. So we have an abundance of oil, an abundance.
And how much of it, I know maybe there's not a specific number, but how much of it are we actually making use of versus bringing it from somewhere else because it's icky and dirty and we don't want to use our own.
We're importing about 67% of the oil is coming from non-foreign producers. Non-U.S. foreign producers. So we're about 23%, and then of our own use comes from California. We import three times that amount from foreign producers, and we're getting a little bit from Alaska now, but not much. So we're getting more and more oil and now gasoline from non-U.S. foreign producers, when in fact we have a lot of oil under our feet. But as Mike Ariza pointed out, you can have a lot of oil, but if you don't have a refiner to sell it to, nobody's going to produce the oil. And we've lost refineries. So we're sort of in this death spiral.
Yeah. So we have
kind of to add to that.
Yeah.
I want to add that California is, in as far as oil reserves,
is fifth in the nation in the United States behind Texas, North Dakota, a couple others. And then Kern County itself is the fifth largest oil-producing county in the nation. We have the reserves. So nobody can tell us we don't have the reserves. But to Mike's point, or Professor's point, if you don't have any refineries, what are we going to do?
Right, you have that problem, right? And so here's the thought process. I think what Gavin Newsom and some of the members of the legislature will do is they're going to say the following: gee, we gave you SB 237 and 2,000 permits a year to increase oil production, and we also gave you AB 30 with it, which is ethanol, that we've said is going to bring the price down by 20 cents a gallon. Well, not going to happen. That's wishful thinking. And walk away from it. When in fact, AB 30 is not going to really help. And AB 237, which is great, we need more production out of Kern, but Kern itself will not compensate for what we need, given the demand strains on production.
And so for people who aren't following this close enough, so Assembly Bill 237 did what, or attempted to do what?
So
237 allowed. Go ahead,
Stan. That was one of your bills. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah. Well, so what happened is it was a Democratic-authored bill to give a stipend to Kern County that already had the EIR, EIR impact studies already done, to drill 2,000 wells over the next 10 years. So if you take a well in Kern County and you drill, you're going to get 20, 30 barrels a day. Well, 30 barrels times 2,000 wells is 60,000 barrels. We're importing a million. We should be drilling thousands of wells, and we should unleash the beast in California and drill in every location like Ventura, L.A., Kern County. There's like five locations that we can get up to that, close to that million barrels a day.
Right. Plus, if I might add, we have a ton of offshore oil. For example, one of the offshore producers is a company called Sable Offshore. They're in the Santa Barbara Channel. Well, they can produce anywhere from 40 to 50,000 barrels a day of oil. Plus, they have about 350,000 pretreated oil in storage tanks right now that they could add to the California system in a matter of days. But of course, there's issues, environmental restrictions applied to the pipeline and a bunch of lawsuits applied to that. So we're not a beneficiary of that production yet. That'll go through a number of court cases, and we expect a resolution, I think, relatively quickly in the month of March. The irony of it is if Sable can't produce that oil and bring it onshore to the California refineries, then they're going to put it on a tanker that just unloaded Iraqi oil. They're going to put California oil on that tanker and bring that tanker to South Korea, make gasoline, and it'll be re-imported to California. So somewhere, somebody thinks that's a much better greenhouse gas emission profile than producing the oil here in California.
And it seems super efficient, too.
Oh, yeah. Let's not say, well, keeping the tankers in business, and they like that. So I guess it's good for, it's good for the foreign carrier tanker. Remember, the tankers that are being used aren't owned by American companies. They're going to be owned by the Chinese, the Greeks, the Japanese, and Iraqis.
Wow.
That's who owns the tankers.
And so are they just hoping that people don't ever really learn about this? I mean, are they just counting on no blowback because people are just completely clueless?
Well, I'm waiting for that. Go ahead, Mike.
Stan's going to have a different perspective on this than me, but I think the issue in California is, well, it's just part of the process. when you look at the typical voter, we have the second highest gasoline, the highest gasoline prices of the lower 48, the second highest utility costs, the first or second highest tax rates, and I just think people are just so conditioned to it that sort of throw their hands up and just figure out a way of living with it. When in fact, they should be asking themselves, does this make sense? And I think that's a problem that we have in our state.
Yeah, problem is, well,
Skinner would call it operant conditioning. When you ring the bell, the dogs begin to salivate, right?
Yeah, and
it's already affecting people. It's affecting farmers up here already. Katie just wrote an article from some farmers I know in Durham, California, where the red dye diesel is starting to climb, and a couple of the farmers sent me their projected diesel use. You know, a small walnut farmer uses about $43,000, 26.6 gallons a day in his operation. Their operations, you know, $43,000 in a year on diesel. And, yeah, I could potentially go to $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. And these aren't big corporations. These are small families trying to make it. They're already seeing the effects. They've already started to see the effects up here.
So I would tell you that, you know, several things have to happen for this crisis. You know, there's got to be a conflict somewhere, some bad weather, a couple of refineries shut down, or another one leaves. There's some things that the problem with the president... California administration, their solution is to import more gas and diesel. That's not a solution. That's just delaying the inevitable. So I told my family that I felt like we should start stocking up on some groceries. We should be a little more conservative in our thought process. And back to the political question you asked, you know, until I ran for state assembly, I'd get my ballot in the mail. I go, what's this? Oh, what's this? What's this? I don't understand this. I'll call Shannon Grove. She'll tell me. So to the professor's point, most Californians can't even understand their ballot because they make it so damn sophisticated you can't.
Yeah.
Well, and they'll word it a way that, oh, well, that sounds good, but it's not good. And,
right.
And so we're caught. I'm really – that was a really good point, by the way, I agree with you, Professor, that we do have a society that does not understand, because I didn't. I was in that same boat.
Well, I think sometimes we have fallen into that thing of, you know, life sucks and then you die, right? We can't make the change. Nothing's going to get fixed. And, I constantly tell people, I'm like, ladies and gentlemen, these people are not electing each other, and they don't elect themselves. Like, their constituents are sending them there. They are us.
That's right.
They are us.
It's super interesting. I lived in California for a long. This is my third time in California, right? So I was born.
You're a recidivist.
Right. I was born overseas, right? And I entered the state as an infant. In San Francisco, off of a boat in my mom's arms. And then I came back to California around 1980. And the 80s were an incredible decade for our state. Just a fantastic decade. And then I came back in 97 to teach for USD. And I noticed a distinct change in the climate of the state and sort of the attitude of the state. And honestly, sort of a degradation of sort of an interest in things and kind of, I don't want to say an apathy, but just what can I do about it other than I have to accept it and get on. And now what we're seeing is if I don't want to accept it and I can, I move out. I mean, what? Mark Zuckerberg just left the state last week, I read. Sylvester Stallone. So, you know, not only companies are fleeing the state, like Oracle and guess what, Chevron, but also now high-profile individuals who can't afford to leave the state or leave the state. So it would seem to me, if I were a policymaker, to be paying a lot of attention to that. I'd be asking these companies, why are you leaving? And these individuals, why are you leaving? And they're going to tell you cost of living, policies, taxes, and just a difficult time to live in California right now. And I think until sort of the rest of us kind of feel that way, we're going to be stuck with take it or leave it because I'm smarter than you type legislation.
Yeah, they have to look at...
We just let that hang there for a second.
Well, they have to look at how many companies have left this state, and this isn't just recently. This is...
No, remember the guy we interviewed like 8 years ago, and he was his business was helping companies relocate in or out of the state. He lived in California, and he was that was his industry, was helping large companies move around. And he said, "Oh yeah, they're leaving in droves." And it was probably 2 years after that I called him to do an interview. Yeah, he was gone too.
Yeah.
He helped a whole bunch of them move out, and then it was like, see ya.
Well, gosh, I mean, I remember when PayPal moved out of California. It was a big deal. That was...
Oh, my gosh, that was a long time ago.
15 years ago. And, you know, that was a lot of jobs right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And it's just continued. I don't know how many big companies are left.
Oh, my gosh, we only have 12 seconds? What's wrong with us?
Yep.
Seven seconds? We'll just count it down.
We're out of time.
Bye, you guys. Thanks a lot. 1 second. We the People Radio. Bye.
We got to get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Somewhere, baby. Somehow I know.